Today's presentation is What Matters by Michael Esalen. It relates to the fourth principle, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. It also relates to the seventh principle, respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part, and maybe more of our principles as well. Michael Esalen serves as the chaplain for the Sims Mann UCLA Center for Integrative Oncology. Two-time TEDx speaker, Michael speaks extensively to healthcare professionals, patient populations, and faith communities across the country. He's also worked as an activist and educator, addressing anti-LGBTQ bias in the larger community for over 30 years. Michael was recently inducted into the UCLA Semmel Institute Eudaimonia Society in recognition of having lived a meaning-driven life. He has four volumes of CDs available for purchase. You can contact him through his website, which is www.michaelesalen.com. So please welcome Michael.
Good morning. It is really a big pleasure to join you from across the country on such a spectacular historical moment as this one. So much joy, so much relief, so much gratitude. But in the midst of all that, we are still in the midst of this devastating and lethal pandemic. And as we are all sheltering in place, it seems like we're all deluged with dozens of unanswerable questions, each one competing for our limited attention and limited capacity to focus. How long is this going to last? How are we going to keep ourselves safe? How are we going to make it financially? How do we live with this kind of uncertainty? As we vacillate between one question or another, whichever happens to be working us over at any particular moment, there might be one question that lies beneath all the others. What matters? A year ago, in honor of the UCLA centennial, I was invited by the UCLA Department of Arts and Architecture to be a presenter at their special 10 questions event, the centennial edition. It was a series of 10 evenings, each one devoted to one particular question for our life and times, each one explored by a multidisciplinary panel from across the university. When I told my husband, Scott, about this honor of having been invited, he, of course, asked me, "What's your question?" "What matters?" I said. "Oh," he said, "everything and nothing." And then he left the room. Pithy, yes, but also true in a way. Everything matters and nothing matters. Our own individual lives, such as they are in this moment, are indeed a compilation of the countless decisions we have made over the course of our lives, both large and small, decisions that were informed and shaped by our idea of what mattered at the time. Do I marry this person or not? Do I live in this city or not? Do I pursue this career or not? Or on a whole other dimension, do I buy this new pair of shoes or save my money? Do I eat that last piece of chocolate cake or let it pass me by? Each decision was shaped by our idea at the time of what matters. On a national level, we only have to look 1 year ago to our Democratic national primary debates to get a cross-section of what matters. Day one of my presidency, we're going to be addressing the healthcare crisis. No, for me, my primary priority is climate change. For me, it's the corruption in Washington or the catastrophe happening at our southern border. And it all matters. But look at what happened in the span of so few months. All of that had been trumped, you should pardon the expression, by the COVID-19 pandemic. Does that mean none of that matters anymore? Of course not. It just means that this has captured our attention now. On a whole other dimension, do you know what else matters? That you get home safely from your next trip to the supermarket, that we have cat food, that Rupert has been fed, or that I have milk for my oatmeal tomorrow morning. I think ultimately what matters is this very moment, the thing that's right in front of us. I remember in the early 80s reading a magazine interview with Rosalynn Carter. This would have been not long after she and Jimmy had moved out of the White House back to their home in Plains, Georgia. At the time of the interview, she was busily engaged in laying a new brick pathway up to the front stoop of their house. She commented to the interviewer about how astonishing it was to reflect that just very few months ago, she and Jimmy had been living in the White House, hosting state dinners, Camp David Peace Accord, all of that. And now the most important thing in the world is that this brick is straight. And it matters, she said. Though I was such a young man, I was so struck by the profundity of that, so much so that it still sticks with me 40 years later. It's almost Zen-like, isn't it? Around the same time, I remember taking some kind of self-development seminar or another, after all, it was the 80s, in which we were given the task of writing our own epitaph. Now, if you've never tried that, it can be a daunting experience, but also illuminating. It also becomes even more daunting when we have to do it for real. My mom died a year ago, April, and there's only so much room on those little bronze plaques. Which few words are you going to choose to summarize, to encapsulate an entire human life? What I chose for myself in my early 20s was, he was moved by life. I think what matters is really quite fluid and changeable over the course of a lifetime, maybe even over the course of an afternoon. What mattered to me at 25 is not what mattered to me at 45, which bears little resemblance to what matters to me today at 65. I think in the first half of life, we are so consumed with pursuing our goals, accomplishing something, achieving success, maybe starting a family, success, as if we have the vaguest idea what that means. The second half of life, I find, is a different story. But one inescapable truth for all of us is that a couple of generations from now, no one will know or care or remember that you even walked the earth. So given that reality, what matters? I have to come back to Rosalind Carter, that the bricks are straight. And yes, while I'm focusing on the brick of this moment, I have to be mindful and attuned to all the enormous problems that plague our world. But when it comes time for me to take my last breath, what will I say matters then? In my role as an oncology chaplain, I would say I'm sort of in the coming out business. I'm creating a safe space for people to come out to me, to tell me their truth, often their deepest truth, and often at the most critical time of their lives, at the end of it. But the way I see it, it's not only a coming out business, it's also a meaning-making business, because once that truth is out there on the table, how do we hold it? How do we contain it? How do we make sense of it? That's part of the gift and exhilaration of getting to do this work. Every day, I get that constant reminder, Michael, pay attention. Particularly as I move well into the third act of my life. When I think back on Acts 1 and 2, I realize how seldom it was that I was ever focused on the brick in front of me. I always had my eye around the corner to the next brick. What's the next thing? How does this decision affect that one? What classes do I take? What do I major in? Which college do I go to? Which career do I pursue? Which relationships do I nurture and pursue to somehow get me closer to wherever it is that I think I want to go? And of course, that's still kind of true in a way, but maybe with less urgency. But then again, perhaps with more urgency, because at this stage of my life, the big what's next for me now is the home stretch, the final reckoning, as it were. So when it comes time for me to take my last breath, what will I say matters then? Of course, there are as many answers to that question as there are people on the planet. And still, I hear common themes from folks who are wrestling with that very question when deciding whether or not to sign up for guaranteed more suffering with the next drug trial, chemo treatment, radiation, or surgery. What makes life worth fighting for? Well, I'd like to see my son graduate high school. I'd like to live long enough to see my daughter get married or my grandchildren be born. Still, I find those to be deceptively simple and tidy answers, seldom revealing the larger picture. Many years ago, I worked on the bone marrow transplant unit at UCLA, leukemia and lymphoma patients mostly, who often spent many weeks, if not months, in the hospital. And there I met Leon, who was a difficult, prickly guy, not at all likable. In all of his weeks in the hospital, I never saw that he had a single visitor. And he almost seemed proud of that fact. "I don't need anybody," he would say. He had his own business and he had a dog who scared the neighbors. Leon identified as an atheist, a secular Jew, and he presumed I was religious and a Christian, neither of which are true, but he used to enjoy duking it out with me, philosophically speaking. So that was the nature of my spiritual care, engaging in these theological discussions with Leon. Once he had his bone marrow transplant, things went south very quickly, and the doctors came in with that awful news. "There's nothing more we can do." And then the heart began to soften and the tears came. But the very next day, the doctors came in and said, "Wait, we think you might qualify for this brand new drug trial." Oh, his spirits went through the roof, mine too. "Leon, this is great news. Tell me, what are you going to do with more time if you get it? I eagerly wanted to know. Here's the very nexus of it. What matters?" "I'd like to finish my invoicing," he said. My heart just sank. In total judgment, I admit, I was not a good chaplain in that moment. I did not ask the next obvious question. "Oh, really? That's interesting. Tell me, why is it that your invoices mean so much to you at this point?" No, I just kind of sat there in stunned silence. I guess I was hoping he'd say, "I'd like to walk my dog on the beach one more time. I'd like to see one more beautiful sunset. I'd like to hear Rhapsody in Blue one more time." "No," he said, "I'd like to finish my invoicing." That's where he found his meaning. That's what mattered. Marianne, in her 40s, had lived the past several years with pancreatic cancer, and I walked the last few months of her journey by her side. Not long before she died, I went to see her in the hospital, and she was hooked up to every kind of tube and pump and hose imaginable. She was absolutely fried, just cooked. "I'm done, Michael. I don't want any more. I'm ready to leave." But it wasn't an option. Her husband and her kids, of course, wanted her to keep fighting, have the next surgery, try the next drug trial. "Let's get a second opinion, a third opinion, a fifth opinion." "I can't die having them think for the rest of their lives that I didn't love them enough to keep trying. Do you think that's what they're going to think of me, Michael?" "Marianne, what would you want right now if you could call the shots?" "That's easy," she said. "I would disconnect all of this. I'd ask my husband to get in bed with me and hold me and look out that window across my room at the tree across the street and say, 'Look at those leaves. Look at how they capture the light and they flutter in the breeze. Isn't that beautiful?'" A God moment, she would call it. Over our months of conversation, she had told me about other God moments that she had had, moments that sort of anchored her into life, moments in which not much really happened, in which the stuff and business of life just fell away, leaving space for awareness of this moment being beautiful and being enough. "I'd like one more God moment," she said. I met Evelyn on her first day of chemotherapy after being newly diagnosed for ovarian cancer. And she came to see me every 2 weeks for the next 6 years. Although she never wanted to talk about anything of any deeper consequence than what she and her husband Gene had done the previous weekend. Despite all my invitation, holding the door open to talk about the deeper themes and questions that are coming down the pike, she never took the bait. I didn't feel like I was doing much of anything, but she would conclude each visit by saying, "Oh, Michael, thank you so much. I always feel so much better just talking to you." I went to see her in the hospital the day before she died. Her husband, Gene, was there, of course. They'd been married just forever. No kids, though. High school sweethearts. The Buddhists believe it's a good idea to be reflecting on the sweet memories of life when one is about to make their transition, that somehow maybe it greases the wheels for the next incarnation. No matter what our beliefs are about such things, it is not a bad idea. So I asked Jean, tell me that story again about how you guys met. I love that story. And he launched into the story, and soon enough, Evelyn was getting a little irritated because she didn't remember. Undaunted, Jean pressed on. Sure you do, honey. Remember we went to that football game and we were in the back seat of that car. And now she was getting very distressed because the memory was gone forever. Jean changed course and said, that's okay, honey. Maybe you're just tired and want to sleep. Tell you what, Michael and I will go out in the hall and we'll chat a bit, give you a chance to rest. How about that? No, she said defiantly. I'm not tired. I don't want to sleep. I want you both here. I just don't want anybody to talk. And so I got on one edge of the bed and Jean sat on the other and we each held a hand and we just sat there in silence, just looking at each other, nothing to do, nothing to say, just the awareness of love, of presence. And for the rest of my life, that moment has imprinted my heart with what truly sacred space looks like. And just maybe the thing that matters most is what's left when everything that we thought had mattered so much has burnt away. So what matters to me today? This conversation matters. Kindness really matters. Friendship, love, of course, humor, kinship, being a witness to one another in our lives, that matters. Communion, an old-fashioned religious word, but I love it, and the imagery of it, taking in and digesting our common humanity, the thing that connects us to each other and to nature and to the source of life itself, that matters. Sure, I'd like to think when I'm breathing my last breath that I'll think that I made a difference, that I relieved some suffering here and there. I provided some encouragement. That I had a blast. That I saw the world. That I loved hard. But I'm not so grandiose as to think it was ever anything more than one conversation at a time. One brick at a time. We go through our lives having so many interactions with so many countless numbers of people, a little encouragement here, a little inspiration there, a laugh here. Those little contacts might have the greatest impact of anything that we do in our lives, all those things that we thought were so important. They, in fact, might be our greatest legacy. Joseph Campbell believes it's important to realize the eternal within, that we should participate with joy in the sorrows of the world. I love that. I come back to it again and again as a kind of a mantra, to participate with joy in the sorrows of the world. I don't know. Maybe it just comes down to being moved by life. So be it. Thank you. Well, I'm not a hospital chaplain. We are the Sims Mann Center. We are on the outpatient side. So I'm providing, before the pandemic, I'm providing support to people in infusion clinics, or they come meet with me as they would a therapist. Or when I'm in the clinic, a doctor might pull me over and say, I'm about to give a patient bad news. Can you come in and be ready here? So it was still face-to-face, but it wasn't in a hospital. If a patient got sick and went to the hospital, I would go see them in the hospital, but the primary basis of my work is in an outpatient setting. Right now, I'm totally on Zoom all day, having sessions with patients, and it is terrible. And it's not remotely the same thing as being there. You're not even making authentic eye contact. The patient's looking down at their computer, and you want them to look at you, and yet you can't touch them, you can't hug them, you can't hold their hand. And then the sound's going out, and there's lack of synchronization. I have a patient that I see for bereavement support, and it was ridiculous. Her emotions are very volatile, as you might imagine, and my computer screen showed her laughing. She had said something that was funny, but I'm hearing her cry. So I'm like a week behind here. How am I supposed to be responding? And what is she seeing? It's not authentic communication. It's the best we got. So how do we listen? How do we create that presence against all of these barriers? And some of it, much of it might be in the same way if you travel to a foreign country and you can't speak the language, what do? You use your eyes, your heart, you hope that your intention is going across this barrier where there's no language, no articulation. Can the heart speak? It's kind of similar to that. How do we do that for each other? Yeah, Zoom is a tool, but it's a flawed one, but it's the best we got. We do have the phone, but these are really hard times. And to really rely on other modes of maybe multidimensional communication that aren't just words in time and space. My role is to, and for any person who's pursuing compassion, as far as I'm concerned, is to be where the person is. I might meet a patient in the infusion clinic, their first day of chemotherapy, they're stressed out of their minds. They were just diagnosed maybe 2 weeks ago, their world is upside down, their head is spinning. And they're going into orbit about trying to find a parking place in the parking structure and how much the parking costs there. That's, I come to them where they are. Isn't it awful? Yeah, I know. To be where they are, to be a witness, to be seen. I've got two kind of illustrations. One is a movie that came out, I don't know, 10 years ago. At this age, everything was 10 years ago. It could have been 15, it could have been 30, it could have been 5. But it was called A Little Miss Sunshine. I don't know if you saw it. Hysterical movie. This family is driving across country. It's very comical. And they're in the middle of the desert somewhere. And their teenage son, whose dream is to be a pilot, discovers reading a magazine that he's colorblind in one of those little colorblind tests, which there goes his dream out the window. He jumps out of the car. He goes, runs in the desert. And the mom doesn't know what to do. And the little girl, Olive, is this sweet kind of dorky little girl. And the mom says, Olive, go talk to your brother. And she goes next to him and just sits there. Does not say a word. Just sits right next to him. And after a while, she just kind of nudges him, leans into him like that. And then he says, okay, let's go. That's a time of perfect compassion. Just being the compassion just means to be with suffering. It doesn't mean fix it, advise it, say something positive, compare it. You should be grateful because just to be with it. And it's not an easy or small thing. I do a lot of speaking. And years ago, I spoke at this cancer support community out in a suburb of Los Angeles to mostly cancer patients. And there was Q&A afterward. And this woman asks me, what's the meaning of life? As if I have that answer. She doesn't wait for my response. She wants to tell me her answer. And she says, I think the meaning of life is that everyone wants to be known. Not as in famous, but as in seen, witnessed. And at the time, I remember my judging mind going into overdrive thinking, well, that's way too simplistic of an answer, but thank you, dear. Is there another question out there? But I've quoted her 10,000 times in the years since, because I think she came close to hitting it right on the money. Just being seen, seeing ourselves and seeing each other without the judgment, without just, I see how hard your life is. So if somebody you know is holding pain or maybe they're talking about harming themselves or something, but they don't want to talk, can you be still and just be with them? And wherever they are, you go with them. Could you believe Stephen Colbert last night? Yeah, what'd you think about this? Well, tell me about it. I didn't see it. make the connection is the sacred piece, not any wisdom you've got. You're not in their shoes. You don't know what they're going through. Not really. So can I be a student of theirs? Tell me, what's it like to be you? How can I sit with you and hear you and understand you? They're suffering like we all are suffering. They want to hug their grandchildren. That, I mean, for a lot of people that get to a certain age, their grandchildren becomes a centerpiece of their lives, and they can't see them, they can't hug them, and they're dying. And so it's sad. There's no way to say, well, let's look at it this way, or at least you've got that. Again, how can I be present? It becomes a spiritual crisis. I feel like I'm in a spiritual crisis. I'm an extroverted person that I get my connection from being with people, not on Zoom. I had to go into work for a meeting, and there's a maintenance person in the elevator go, oh, a person, how was your day today? I mean, the most inconsequential conversation just gave me oxygen. I love travel more than anything. I love going to the theater, cabarets, concerts, socializing, going to movies. All of that's taken away from me. I going swimming every day at the gym. Those are the things that keep me afloat spiritually, counterbalance all of this suffering. It's not available to me. It becomes a spiritual crisis. How do I be present in it? Try to find other sources of oxygen. It's not the same. There's no shortcut around the suffering. So how do I put faith in the idea, like the Pema Chodron quote, am I getting annihilated so I can discover what's truly indestructible within? If I can make peace with that as the process I'm in right now, rather than how do I get the same buzz I used to get from going to see a great film, that's a higher goal. I'm not remotely there, but I do see that as my task. I think we need to let go of the idea that the goal is to hurt less and that life is always supposed to be joyful and pleasant. And it's just not. It's not built that way. We're all going to lose everything. Everything we have, everything we love, everything we are, we're all going to lose it, guaranteed. So does that mean that we ultimately fail? Some would say yes. You know, some, interestingly enough, I find that super religious people, evangelical Christian most particularly, like in a end-of-life situation in an ICU where someone is so far gone, I mean, maybe brain dead or their skin's so weak it's falling off if you touch them, and the family saying, no, we cannot allow a natural death here. We have to give God a chance to do a miracle. Interestingly, when the faith tradition is based on the whole idea that it gets better on the other side, often those folks are the most to try every scientific measure possible to keep cells alive. I remember a family who asked me, you know, we have to give God a chance to do a miracle. And I kind of took a risk and just said, what if death is the miracle? If birth is a miracle, and everybody seems to say that, isn't it a miracle, new life, then by definition, death has to be too. It just has to be. It's a mystery. You were here, and then you're gone. What happened? Where did you go? Are you still there? Were you here, really? I'm so sorry for your pain. And that you couldn't be there to hug her. This is a tragedy. This is a tragic situation. Well, I invite you to perhaps close your eyes where you are and take a few nice deep breaths with me. And breathing in the love, the intention, the commitment of this community to come together and to connect, despite all that there is now to separate us physically. As we exhale, can we release the light and the radiance of our coming together, not only back to one another, but to the larger circles of life? Let's even stretch our arms out right now where you are and imagine our embrace of each other and those larger circles of life, getting a sense of our connectedness in a place beyond time and space. Despite the physical isolation of this moment, as we breathe Into that embrace, let's absorb the words of the poet Rilke as a blessing to ourselves. Be patient toward all that is unsolved in your heart. Try to love the questions themselves, like locked rooms and like books written in a very foreign tongue. Do not seek the answers which cannot be given to you, because you would not be able to live them. Live the questions now. Perhaps you will then gradually, without noticing it, live along some distant day into the answer. So be it.
Thank you again. Thank you again, Michael.
Thank you.
And to everyone who attended.